Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started.
Okay.
Yep.
We're going to talk to you.
Hasn't been doing anything, but that's why she's mad.
Yikes. Okay, I'm going to really try to project my voice. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning. Brook Island County Board of Supervisors elected officials breakfast on this day, November 20th, 2023. We would like to welcome you to this occasion. I think we all will look forward to this time. And it's very special to me because this will be the last time that I will be present to sit among you. So we're going to stand. The flag is over here and say the pledge and have a moment. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. Board, our first thing is to adopt the agenda.
Second.
We have the adoption this day by Mr. O'Brien and second by Mr. Shirley. All in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? And Mrs. Eager is absent today. Okay. So we want to start off by welcoming you again, and not only our elected officials, we also want to welcome members of the school board and people working in our county. And as you look around, all these people work very hard for Fluvanna County, and we are very glad that you could take your time and have the opportunity to be here. I'm going to make the introductions, and hopefully I will get them all correct. If not, I don't mind you saying, hold up, Jose. that is not correct. I don't think they're in any particular order of how you're seated. So if you would acknowledge yourself, I think we all know you, but maybe there's some people that may not know who you are. So the first one I have on my list is Tom Garrett. To the House. And the next one I have is Congressman Bob Gooden. He's at the other end of the table. And his person with him is Chris Snyder. Chris has been here a couple of times, so kind of familiar with him. We have Taylor Thornhill, and she is a representative for Senator Kane's office. We have Cole Kawugala, and he is a representative for Warner's office. And we have Archer McGriffin, representative for McGuire's office. Didn't miss anybody there? No. Okay. So we welcome you. First thing on our agenda, want to get right to why we are here. We want general remarks by the legislators and those individuals who are representatives. We'll start off, and why don't we start off at Tom? I'll let you start out. What we're doing is giving general remarks. So, and introductions to yourself.
So generally, thank you for having us. I wish, I hope that as you speak to your peers and colleagues in Cumberland, Buckingham, Appomattox, Prince Edward, Ushland, et cetera, that you ask them to do the same thing. I just think this is so useful. I will make you happy and let you down every single legislative session. But, you know, if you understand sort of the government that we were handed, I should be listening to you guys. And that guy down there and you guys should be listening to us. And that should work both ways, right, up and down. And so these are really useful. This is also kind of awesome to sort of write up here so that as I drift in and out in my, as I want to do, I've got kind of the concepts of what y'all's values are and what your priorities are. So just mostly thank you for having me, and I'm happy to be here. And if anybody doesn't have my number, then somebody in this room does, I promise. But you're welcome to also approach me and y'all are, you know, if I'm not listening to you, I'm not doing my job right. So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. I do want to point out, you referred to these sheets, individuals that are here to talk about these concerns. School board and many people sitting around the table and said, so you'll be able to hear our concerns. So we move on to you, Ms. Archer.
Hi, I'm Archer. I'm Delegate McGuire's legislative assistant, and we are looking forward to transitioning into the Senate. Lots going on, new building, no office, no phone number, no email yet. So just kind of working on that, but you can easily get a hold of us at our either our delegate email at the time, or you know, by our phone number, we'll still be working. So, but basically, we're just kind of excited about a new session.
Thank you. Colin.
Hi all, my name is Cole Kabubulay. As you can see, I'm not Senator Warner himself. I am the Richmond Region Outreach Representative. So it's a kind of a whole swath of Central Virginia. I've been with the Senator for just under 2 years now, but just doing outreach in September. So I'm just kind of getting out and meeting everyone. Here to listen today, if you guys have anything you need, I can give you my card, just reach out, shoot me a text, give me a call. Yeah, it's great to be here, appreciate the invite.
Thank you.
Yes. All right, Chris Snyder, field director for the congressman here. I think I've met with most of you before, and this is my home away from home, the first Tuesday of the month in the morning for office hours. So you're always free to drop by and see me or refer constituents to me for any kind of casework issues, policy concerns. Doesn't have to be limited to federal. Typically, that's what we deal with, but many times people don't know. So I'm a good starting point. I've also worked in the state Senate and been an elected official at the local level, so pretty much can determine who the right person is to talk to when there's an issue. So thank you for doing this again.
Good morning, great to be with you. Thanks for including us. To add to what Chris said a moment ago, our office works very hard on the casework and constituent services and district outreach, and Chris is an example of that. In our first 3 years, we have resolved we have recovered for citizens of the 5th District who are owed by their federal government over $20 million, I think it's about $22 million now, and have resolved thousands of cases, about 6,000 cases, I think the number is, for constituents of the 5th District, meaning they've reached out to their federal government for help, they've reached out to the congressional office. And we are always happy to advocate for you if you've got something in James River Water Authority. Eric and I were just talking about that, and Chris has helped on that. To advocate for you for help on that after 10 years, those kind of things, if you reach out, we're glad to do that. I would encourage you, if you've not done so, to sign up for our newsletter. If you just go to the good.house.gov, the congressional site, I have nothing to do with politics or campaign, but just as your congressional rep, we do put out a weekly newsletter to let you know what we're working on in Washington, to let you know when we're doing mobile office hours in your respective county, to make it easier for your constituents to get help from us. And we do teletown calls, typically on a quarterly basis. We just did one last week, but we're taking as many calls as we can from folks around the 5th District. A couple other things from D.C., if I may. I guess the hope that I would give you, because setting aside politics and party and that sort of thing, I think the divide in Washington is between those who think Washington is working for you. I would submit it is not. Washington is working for Washington. And that anything, much of anything that we're doing there is actually working or helping make the country better. I would submit most of it is not. But the hope that I would give you is we have brought a lot of change to the House this past year, so far in these last now almost 11 months, we have returned to, because of what we have forced upon the Congress, we have brought a return to regular order, where your elected representatives have a voice in legislation. We have now single-issue legislation instead of, you know, massive bills, thousands of pages long, dealing with, you know, dozens of different subjects. We have a minimum amount of time to read legislation before we vote on it. We have reinstated that minimum amount of time. We now allow amendments to legislation, so your elected representatives can make, you know, we don't have to just take a bill as is, up or down vote, but we're instead can make changes, propose things to add to it or things to take away from it, and have members go on record voting for those amendments, you know, and which can has the opportunity to make legislation better. It allows the minority party, for that matter, in the House to have a voice that we did not have the previous 2 years. We're working through the respective committees of jurisdiction now, instead of it going directly to the floor from the all-powerful Rules Committee. That's what's called regular order, the way that the House is intended to work, and we have a chance to make change. As you all know, we have a new speaker, and the reason we have a new speaker is some of us who didn't feel like the current track was sustainable for this Congress, for the country. We're trying to pass our 12 appropriation bills for the first time in decades. That's the change that we're forcing on Washington. Meaning last year, as an example, there was a 4,000-page omnibus bill, took all, we're required by statute to pass 12 annual appropriation bills. In other words, the government, all the funding of the government is split into 12 different funding bills where we vote on those individually, or we're supposed to anyway, where we as members are accountable for how we spend your hard-earned tax dollars. We haven't done that in decades, about 25 years. We've only done it like 4 times in 50 years. So last year was a classic example of Washington's failure. In December, there was a 4,000-page omnibus. I mean, take all the bills together. We only got a few hours to read it. Obviously, that means we didn't read it. And it passed, unfortunately, and we're suffering under those policies and those spending levels here today. We're trying to break that apart and not do that anymore. And so the conflict you see on the House side is trying to restore the People's House back to the way the People's House is supposed to operate. And you know, those bills may not reflect your wishes or my wishes. They may not reflect the spending levels or the policies that you would like, or maybe they do. But at least your members are accountable for how that process is working. I would say, why is that so necessary? We have $34 trillion in debt now. Okay, I'm fudging a little, it's about 33.7 trillion. But $34 trillion in debt. We are running a $200 billion deficit every month. We're on track for about a $2.4 trillion deficit this year. We have never had this level of debt in the history of the country except during World War II. We had a reason for it in World War II. We don't have a reason for it now. It's just both sides failing you, failing their constituents. The interest on the debt is almost $1 trillion a year now. And the interest rates that are higher than they've been in 20 years are because of bad policy, because of the inflation that's been caused by bad policy and spending, and a reaction to, I would submit, a futile effort to try to reduce the inflation by raising the interest rates, which are further crushing you and your constituents and your communities. And then because of the credit rating being, we've had our credit rating downgrade. I hope you realize that. Fitch and Moody's have both lowered our credit rating this year, first time that's happened, which is going to cause interest rates to go up even further. So everything we do in Washington should be through a look through a fiscal lens. We are bankrupt. We don't have the money. One of the reasons why we required the speaker, thankfully he wanted to do this, but to fund even support for Israel with cuts in spending is because Israel is fiscally solvent. We are not. To think about, should we borrow from our kids and grandkids to support another country, even if you support that other country, as I absolutely do, we're trying to cut spending in order to pay for that because, quite simply, we don't have the money. You obviously couldn't operate your county that way. Thankfully, Delegate Garrett knows better than I do, but in Richmond, they're not able to operate the state that way. But in Washington, we print more or we borrow more. But your people are suffering because of bad policy on energy, climate, environmental extremism, gas prices, utility prices are crushing your people, housing prices are crushing your people because of bad policy. The inflation, as I've mentioned, grocery prices, people are suffering as a direct result of bad policy in Washington. We are trying to change that. So you've seen the chaos and the circus at the House. This House, by the way, has passed 7 of those 12 spending bills so far, individual bills. We're trying to pass all 12 by the end of the year. We passed 7. That's historic with this Congress. The Senate has passed 3. We passed 7. Even though we worked on the Speaker for 3 weeks, they've passed 3, we passed 7. And those 3, they packaged together in a minibus. They haven't passed any individual spending bills. We've passed 7 of about 12. So we are working hard to change Congress. I hope that you recognize that Congress has not been working for you, and the country cannot sustain the current track. I won't go into detail on the border, but I hope that you're terribly concerned about the border invasion that's happening. I hope that you recognize that what happened in Israel will happen here because of the border invasion. It's absolutely going to happen here in a much more larger scale because of who we have helped or led into our country. So the stakes are high in Washington. We're here, Chris and I, to listen to you, to see how we can advocate better for you and support what you're doing, and frankly, fight against what Washington does to you while pretending to do things for you, mandates, regulations, unpaid mandates, and things like that. Well, so thanks for letting us be with you this morning.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Taylor Thornhill. I'm the regional director at Senator Kane's Richmond office. I've been with the senator for a little over 4 years now, first half as regional assistant and now as regional director. I'm really happy to be here today. This is one of my favorite types of meetings, actually listening to the folks in the localities and what they're having issues with, so I can take that back to the senator. If there's anything that I can help with, whether it be in regards to casework, bringing the senator to Pluvanna one day, hopefully, or if it's congressionally directed spending applications that you might be interested in, please let me know. If I'm not the right person to talk to, I can connect you to the appropriate person in our office, but I'm really happy to be here today. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank all of you. Now we're going to look at the list that we have, the legislative concerns, and we have individuals here who would like to speak to those concerns. We welcome you to do that. We'll start off with schools and education. We have our superintendent here, Dr. Gratz. We have a board member, Mr. Charles Rittenhouse, representing Cunningham, and we have James Kelly, the chair of the school board representing the District of Palmyra. And I don't know how you want to handle it, but I would assume you would do the first part together. All right.
Well, thank you, Ms. Booker, and thank you, everybody. We're very, very happy to be here. I want to make it clear that what we have on here is not, it doesn't reflect the school board having gotten together and formally voted to approve a legislative agenda. They've not chosen to do that this year, but having said that, I do believe that we're all on the same page with this, and I'm happy to answer questions, or board members can answer questions. I won't read this to you, but this is not gonna be anything new to anyone. We're advocating for fully supporting the SOQ funding, lifting the support cap that was imposed in 2010. Just from my personal vantage point, I'm vice president of the Coalition of Small and Rural Schools, which is 85 of the 132 school divisions. We got together specifically because there are a lot of policies that come out of Richmond that I don't think recognize the specific unique impact that some of these things have on small rural places. I mean, maybe you will understand that, but this is one of them. When the governor approves salary increases, and there's always a match because it goes through the SOQ funding formula as well as the local composite index. And our county has been exceedingly generous, in my opinion, 3 years. But the burden of funding that falls on small rural localities that don't have any place to go for that funding except to people's pockets. And so I think I'm very appreciative of what the state did last year to increase the ratio with SOQ funding. in addressing the support gap issue. And I would just ask on behalf of this community that, again, has been very generous to the schools, that in the upcoming session, you would just continue to consider bringing that back to what it was in 2010 and fully lifting that gap. Anything that our board members want to add, or any questions that you all have for me? Obviously, other issues that will come out from the coalition, as well as Virginia Association of School Superintendents.
Dr. Goetz, would you voice over the impact on rural divisions and specifically Fluvanna, if you can, for when that alleged stopgap was put in place? And so what does that mean?
No, it's all good. I wasn't there.
So yeah, it's been many years. It isn't a stopgap if it's permanent. But could you articulate, what is the cap? Why was it put in place? And then how much has the county been paying annually for something that was supposed to be somewhat temporary relief?
I can. I was, in fairness, I was in Goochland at the time.
Of course.
And do remember meeting with you there in 2012. So the cap was played, the standards of quality indicate for every so many students you have to have a certain number of positions. So their professional positions and their support positions. There was a cap placed in 2010 on the number of those that could be funded. And from the seat I was in, I think it was passed by the General Assembly as kind of an emergency measure to keep the state from financially imploding at the time. We were in a terrible recession. I know that in Fluvanna at that time, that year alone, there was over $900,000 in state basic aid that did not come to Fluvanna as a result of that. In Goochland, what that looked like for us was we had to lay off a bunch of people and we imposed furlough days. I'm not sure what happened in Fluvanna. Having come here now, I believe what happened was there were a lot of positions that were lost because I think a lot hadn't come back yet. Over the life of that, because it has continued to be imposed year after year, it's almost $9 million in state funding that this locality has had to either come up with or do without. And again, I think the state made great measures last year to address that. I hope we'll keep going.
Great. And then I'll say as an individual board member, that one of the things that's not on here that I think we should take some time to reconsider is the way that we implement standardized testing in Virginia. I know that we've recently gone through some changes, and while I have no reason to doubt best intents, I find that the outcome of our standardized testing really just doesn't fit the bill. I think there are just remarkably smarter and better programs that exist that provide real tracking data, real assessment year over year, and real growth measures, things like MAP testing, that ultimately may very well be on the chopping block in Fluvanna. They're the best tool we have beyond teacher assessment in the classroom to see how a kid is developing and in what particular areas they need additional attention. But it's coming at additional cost to us in a lot of ways, because not only must we do what is mandated from the state, but then we have to decide, we have this really great thing that helps our teachers and helps us identify students who need help and where they need help. And so we're left with the must-dos, the nice-to-haves, and then ultimately a lot of good assessments left on the cutting room floor. And at least, you know, as much as I can dive into the data and look at things, I'm just not sure that it ultimately provides the tracking data that we need. And states like Texas have adopted a statewide MAP license, and they use that as their internal assessment for the state level. And so I think we should really reconsider the way that we're doing this. I know that there's been changes at the helm of the Department of Ed in the state of Virginia, and hopefully those changes will ultimately lead to individuals who have more perspective, especially for local divisions and rural divisions. But I think finding a better tool that provides real growth data, and then ultimately having it be consistent year over year instead of the changes that we've seen, will only lead to better student outcomes.
Thank you. Yes.
I'm stuck on Congressman Good's comments on the border, and y'all are thinking that I'm not sequiturating away from education, but I don't think I am. According to the CDC, there's about 10,000 children born in the United States every day. And there was a period of about 30 days when the number of people apprehended at the southern border was about 12,000. Between 10 and 12. So we had more people getting caught on the southern border every day than there were people being born in the United States every day. And that will, I mean, you don't have to look. I'm a history major, so I don't know math all that well. But that's going to change your demographic. I'm curious as to whether you have PPE per pupil expenditure numbers here at the county level, and what do you have per pupil expenditure numbers here at the county level for kids who are in ESL programs? I didn't even ask if you had them, because I presume you have to. Although, you know, Fluvanna's not Fairfax, there's just a lot of people coming here who have extra needs, and I want us to meet those needs, but until the federal government does their job, that's another drain on your resources. So I'd love to get that data if you have it. If you have it right now, I'll be extraordinarily impressed. I presume you don't. And then the other thing is that, and maybe I'm slipping in my old age, I didn't remember that there was a coalition of small and rural schools, but I'm glad there is. I would love for you to reach out to your peers in the 56th and sort of form a cabal to nudge me as it relates, because every school in my district is small and rural, right? When Lake Monticello is your highest population density in your district, it might be rural. that was sarcasm, but it makes a point. So, because I want to hear from you. I get frustrated with the Sheriff's Association taking a position because they represent sheriffs from Henrico and Fairfax and Norfolk. And I'm glad there's a law enforcement sheriff's association, because what you do is entirely different than what they do in Fairfax. But since there's 1.3 million people in Fairfax, they scream louder than y'all. So I want to hear from the Coalition of Small and Rural Schools, and I want to hear from the law enforcement sheriffs, because those are the interests I need to represent. But my job, one of them, is to yell at the congressmen and the senators about what's going on at the federal level as it impacts my job at the state level, because that's going to impact your jobs at the local level. So, some sort of group of small and local school boards that can get in my ear quickly would be awesome. Data on per pupil expenditure versus per pupil expenditure for students in ESL is, I think, compelling, and that would be useful to make these arguments in Richmond. And so that's kind of what I'm asking you guys for.
I'm sure we can take that as an action item to support that too.
I want to help these young people, I do, but I mean, we can't turn a blind eye to the reality. It changes your job, it changes my job, which means y'all need to do y'all's job. So, anyway, y'all's is a word where I'm
going. I've asked our Board of Supervisors, Mike Sheridan, who serves on the Education Steering Committee, for VACO to make some comments.
To follow up on your point about Fairfax, I represent, I believe it's 9 counties on the board of directors of VACO, and Fairfax has 5 representatives on the board of directors. So I am speaking for 9 counties, and they have 5 people speaking for 1. But I imagine you probably had the JLARC study placed in front of you. The JLARC study, if I remember correctly, says that right now we are $750,000 behind in education funding from the state level. One of my colleagues on the VACO board is stepping down, Billy Geiger, has a great comment. He says, you never have a surplus till your bills are paid. And that's one of the things that we've talked about with the VACO board. We are getting, in Fluvanna County, I'll tell you exactly what $750,000 is. That's 2 cents on the tax rate. Okay, plus a little bit. And that's what's killing us right now, is the fact that we're stepping up, we're trying to do what has to be done, but we can't keep going above and beyond. Eventually it's going to become a breaking point, and we have to have that help that was taken away 13 years ago, and that was before your time, Tom. So, and we got 2 new representatives, and I'm not sitting here trying to bash, but one of the big statements that I heard at our VACO conference last week was, in education funding, we are behind all of our neighboring states. We're behind Maryland, West Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee, per pupil expenditures. Now, they did not throw out the exact numbers, or if they did, I can't remember them. But that, to me, was a big statement. And I know another one of the things that we have, something that I bring up quite often, is COCA, the cost of competing allowance for Northern Virginia. We were given a bar graph. I took the county supervisor's course this past year. They gave us a bar graph, and they said, we're going to throw away the 12 counties that don't fit on the graph or skew the information because they're either so highly paid or so underpaid. There were nine of them at the top that were thrown away. Well, of those nine at the top, three of them are people that we compete with every day. Charlottesville, Albemarle, and Rico. So that's the biggest thing I can say is thank you for everything that was done. But I know that I've been a teacher now for a long time. 30-something. But anyway, when those cuts were made, you talked about the effects of it in Goochland. In Fluvanna, we had furlough days. We had positions lost. The next big thing that really hurt us was when the state would be kind enough to give us a 2% SOQ raise, they would say an average 2% raise. So what I found as a teacher, my raise was about 0.1% for 8 years, or 0.2%. I didn't say one or two, I said point. The increase that we got as people that have been teaching for a while, I could go to McDonald's for a family, and that was before the new prices started. I don't think I would be able to afford that now. Okay? So just to give you some perspective, and if you ever need to reach out, I know I've got Representative Garrett on speed dial. So, but anyway, if you ever need to reach out, I've been in education for 37 years. Drive a school bus. There's not too many facets of it. I have not tried. So I'm not going to say I'm an expert, but anytime you want to call, I'll call.
Thank you, Mike.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Could I respond to what Mr. Garrett said, since he sort of impugned us on the federal level? I would say appropriately, but may I respond to
that? Yes.
I talked about the deficit and the national debt. We're at the greatest fiscal crisis ever. You could argue that's the greatest threat to the country. You could also argue the border invasion. I use that term intentionally. That's in D.C., by the way. When I say invasion, my friends across the aisle get mad at me. They don't care about the invasion. They don't like me to call it the invasion because it is a willful, purposeful, intentional invasion of the country facilitated by the president. And I say that in the sense that when you had eliminated largely illegal immigration. I shouldn't say illegal immigration. You cannot immigrate legally. I mean, illegally, rather. Immigration, by definition, is a legal process. And we as a country allow about 1 million legal immigrants a year. We're the most welcoming country in the history of the world to immigrants who come through the process legally. I get to participate in naturalization ceremonies, which are one of the most greatest honors I get to do, along with honoring our veterans as a member of Congress. But the illegal is unconscionable, what's happening. And the toll that it will take, and Delegate Garrett mentioned that with respect to education. And I say this, I hope that you realize the massive scale. And I've not talked with Sheriff Hess about this, but other sheriffs across this 5th District who tell me the criminal element that is causing in their respective counties, even though we're far removed physically from the border as a state. But when you're talking, as Delegate Garrett said, we are over 200,000 illegals to come into the country with the help of the administration, meaning they surrendered because we stopped the Remain in Mexico policy, which the previous president had, which said if you come to the country and you try to claim asylum, 90% of which are fraudulent claims, by the way, you had to remain in Mexico to wait for your case to be heard. We didn't just release you into the country while you're waiting for 3 years for a court date. You had to remain in Mexico. Well, since 90% of them are fraudulent, these individuals began to realize, oh gosh, if I'm not gonna get in the country, I have to wait in Mexico for my case to be heard. What's the point in making this illegal effort to try to get in the country? And Mexico, by the way, since they had to keep them in Mexico, all of a sudden got concerned about their own southern border, because instead of letting them just pass through to us, that in addition to the border wall itself, which got stopped obviously when this president was sworn in addition to we used to have detain, meaning keep it at the border or return to their home country, and now we have what's called catch and release. You just let them in. When they surrender, you give them free health care, free social services, free education, free travel, free housing, and you release them into the country. And that's why New York City is now fussing about it, because it's costing them after they wanted to be a sanctuary city. But in the education system, you're required now to teach and accommodate these children in their own language, which isn't as big of a problem in Virginia as it is in other. How could we possibly do that? And you mentioned that we're spending lower than other states, but yet we're flooding the country with illegals and requiring our education institutions to absorb them. How, I don't know. And the scope and the scale of the problem. So this administration has released and allowed some 6-7 million in 3 years that I've just described. Then there are the, and this is what I talked about with what happened in Israel is going to happen here. There's 1.5 to 2 million estimated gotaways, the ones who evade encounter with Border Patrol for the free stuff. They're wearing the carpet shoes, they're dressed in camo head to toe, they're trafficking children, fentanyl, and they have terrorist ties and criminal ties. By the way, the ones who surrender to Border Patrol for all the free stuff, we find about 100 annually who have terrorist ties. How many do you think might be out of the ones who evade apprehension? So just take the conservative number is 1.5 million gotaways in 3 years. If only 10% of them are really bad actors, I don't think you take that bet, but 10%, that's 150,000 individuals. 2,000 people did what happened in Hamas, with Hamas in Israel. 19 people did 9/11 here 22 years ago. But the cost on our education system, the cost on our healthcare system, the cost on our social services agenda more broadly, and not to mention from a national security standpoint, from a local law enforcement standpoint, and what do you think I ought to do as a member of Congress when we have a willful, purposeful, intentional invasion facilitated by the president? Senate has no interest, by the way. Should we just keep funding this government and giving the Department of Homeland Insecurity their budget every year to use to facilitate this invasion? Just keep writing the checks and just give them the money. Fuss about it. Do press conferences and speeches on the House floor, but keep giving them money. We are trying to leverage the budget process to say, White House, you must secure the border. You must reverse these policies. You must stop the harm that's being done to the country. But we're not going to give you money. Now, some don't agree with, let's just fund it anyway and fuss about it. I don't agree with that. But since Bill Garrett mentioned it, I'm among those who believe we should do whatever it takes to force this White House to secure the border and not allow this to happen. And it's harming our schools as well. Sorry, Madam Chair, last thing I'll just say. How many should we let? There's about 7 billion people that don't live in the United States on the planet. About 7 billion. How many of them would come here if they could? And what's the end game here? To Delegate Garrett's point, if you're not having patriotic, merit-based assimilation, embracing our culture, our language, our values as a nation, you're just coming in illegally. When do we cease to be America? At what point when it's exceeding the birth rate in this country? And maybe some people think that's wonderful. I happen to think there's some American exceptionalism that's worth preserving through a merit-based legal immigration process, and we don't have that.
Thank you. Thank you. Do we have any other comments for schools and education? We have to move on to the other. We move to health and human services. We do have our director of social services here, Ms. Kim May. Kim, would you like to speak to this topic? Come up this way, Kim.
I would like just to mention a couple of things, particularly about foster care. I know you may or may not hear a lot about foster care, but it seems like it's always under review, or there's things out there about it. It was the subject of a JLARC review a couple of years ago, and it was just the subject of a Commission on Youth study, and the Commission on Youth made several recommendations, all of which we support. One of the major issues that we've seen in foster care over the last couple of years is, you might have heard it called high acuity youth, and that's older children in foster care that have a lot of mental health and behavior issues, where we're not able to find a placement for the youth, and then our staff have to stay with the youth in our office overnight. This happens a lot. It came to the knowledge of the governor last year, and the governor created the Safe and Sound Task Force, which brought together, because foster care is not just a foster care problem, but it involves a lot of different agencies. And so the Safe and Sound Task Force brought together a lot of the state agencies, private facilities, people from the governor's office, to really look at this issue and figure out what the problem is so we can put a stop to this practice. So they are in the process of trying to put some things together, and there may be some legislation recommended as a result of this, but a couple of things that's been happening. One thing is there was a pilot for an exceptional circumstance payment where if a child is going to stay in our office, if we can find a foster care that's willing to take that child in addition to the basic enhanced maintenance payments, we can pay an additional $3,000 a month up to 3 months for them to keep the child in their home, and we have been using that. And it has really helped us keep some kids out of our office this year. And so that's a pilot, and I would really like to see that practice continue. And also some of the other things that the Commission on Youth was looking at was worker retention problems in child welfare. It's becoming especially difficult to recruit and retain a child welfare staff, particularly in foster care, because those jobs have become so difficult. And another issue with the children staying in DSS offices, I think I read somewhere there may be some legislation proposed this year. One of the issues is that in Virginia, a child has to be 14. If they're 14 or older, they have to consent to mental health treatment. And so what happens is when we have a child in our care and our FAP and our CPMT feels that that child needs residential treatment to address their behavior and emotional and mental health concerns, if that child is over 14 and they refuse the placement, they don't have to sign. And no treatment facility will take them if they don't sign. And then we have to find a less restrictive placement that may not be the best and safest placement for that child. So one of the things that I believe I read was legislation was looking at maybe increasing that age from 14 to 16. And so we would certainly be in support of that as well. So I know I probably said that very quickly, but I know there's a lot on the agenda, so I didn't want to take up too much time, but I'm happy to answer any questions that you all have, and I really do appreciate you taking the time to come out and listen to us this morning.
Thank you, Kim. Any questions? No.
Thank you.
Okay. We have next community economic and workforce development. Jennifer?
You want to talk some of these points? Like I said, I can add it to. And some of these are just, some of these things are VACO topics and VACO legislative priorities. And some of them are certainly more pertinent to Fluvanna County. And certainly, you know, just from an economic development standpoint, you know, certainly we would like to make sure that there's policies at the state level that help to boost or bolster local and regional efforts for economic development. And then I'll just say, you know, certainly, and Jennifer, you want to talk about the rural piece of economic development?
Sure. Jennifer Schmack, I'm the Director of Economic Development here in Fluvanna. We have a lot of great policies in place for economic development incentives as it relates to site readiness and all of those things, workforce development. But from a rural perspective, a rural economic developer, we
we are challenged, right? Our hands are tied when it comes to the matches and all those things, similar to what schools have just discussed. I just completed the Virginia Rural Leadership Program, and we traveled around to the different areas. And one of the things that came up as a topic was a secretary for rural Virginia. And I think it's a great idea, especially when you get into the trenches of economic development, you look at the incentives that we have to come up with and match from that area.
Any questions?
Government or governor level secretary for rural Virginia?
That's what has been talked about over the summer. I believe Cardinal News had brought up that idea. Delegate Kilgore spoke towards it when we were out in southwest Virginia.
I'm vehemently opposed to expanding government, but I love the idea.
Well, especially when they can travel and really learn about our areas, right?
Well, I mean, we don't have a voice. If you have all the population, you have all the media outlets. If you have all the media outlets, you have all the messaging. If you have all the messaging, then who doesn't have it gets forgotten.
Right. And I think, you know, to expand upon that, you know, each rural area is different. So, you know, Southwest Virginia has Coalfields money, you know, the Tobacco Commission. We're just above that. And, you know, we're sitting in the area of Central Virginia that we don't have the additional incentives to be able to work on site readiness projects. So we're kind of that weird gray area right outside of the shadow of Charlottesville and Richmond. So.
Thank you, and she's doing a great job for us. Anything else you want to add, Eric?
No, like I said, certainly just any, you know, support for any type of workforce programs for students, you know, certainly. As we talked about, there's a shortage in the labor market, and certainly anything that we can do to get those students, whether they're coming right out of high school or those that are kind of earlier in their career looking to make a change, or, you know, whether it's going into trades or whatever it is, you know, certainly any programs that would support workforce readiness. And then, Madam Chair, if
yes.
you want, I'll just
next
touch
line.
Briefly on the general government finances.
Eric, could I jump in on that? No,
certainly, please, yes.
Delegate Garrett said, I would echo that. I'm vehemently opposed to the expansion of government generally, but particularly at the federal level, second on the state level, but the local level. And I told Jennifer this when we met a little earlier. When I was the county supervisor, one of those few areas where I did want us to invest resources was in economic development. I saw the return that it made, and I think those dollars are best at that local level where, you know, federal government doesn't really, we like to say, oh, we created it. Federal government created jobs. That's not really true. But what we can, as a government can do is try to facilitate an environment where you succeed and you're not inhibited in your success. You're not put mandates and barriers and obstacles in your path through regulation, taxes, and bad trade policy and massive federal spending. But on the local level, I think it is a worthwhile investment, and so I certainly, as a supervisor, prioritize that, and so appreciate what you do.
Yep. Yeah, so it's under general government, like I said, nothing too deeply to get into, but, you know, certainly from the comp board standpoint, you know, making sure that the comp board is in line with what current salaries are. The comp board funding program has not necessarily been keeping up with the times, you know, as localities have been having to increase salaries over the past 3-4 years. The comp board's not even close to being competitive or current with what those funding needs are. So again, just anything to support additional funding at the comp board level for our constitutional officers. Addition, just, you know, relaxation of the Dillon rule, just in order to allow local authorities to have a little more control of what they're doing. And then lastly, certainly, and you know, I think this kind of goes back to the rural piece, you know, if there's any legislation that comes forward, you know, a lot of times there's legislation that moves forward that provides either some fiscal impact or, as we like to call it, an unfunded mandate on those localities. At times, you have these larger localities that have the manpower to really dig into that and really understand and really be able to see what those fiscal impacts are. On a smaller locality level, we necessarily don't have those resources. We don't have the, you know, the three deep staff of any one position to be able to look at those impacts. You know, we're trying to go through and we're trying to maintain just the day-to-day of county operations, much less so, you know, these bills are coming through and they're getting passed, and You know, sometimes the fiscal impact is probably more than a small locality can deal with at times. So just, you know, certainly just, you don't want to just urge any bills that come forward, please make sure that the fiscal impact for localities is certainly taken into consideration. So thank you. And I'm happy to answer any questions on any of those topics.
Okay. If not, we will go to public notice, public hearing, and public procurement.
Yes, I'll handle that. Dan Whitson, county attorney. Been in Flevan since June, but I've been in local government for 13 years. So dealt a lot with public hearings over those years. And the changes that were made July 1st in the General Assembly, there were some unintended effects of that. So basically now when the Board or Planning Commission has a public hearing and the Board or Planning Commission defers it, we now have to hold another public hearing. So for instance, 2 months ago, Planning Commission had six public hearings. They were all deferred, and we're there about 3 hours. So now we'll basically have to have those public hearings all over again, even though you're only required to have one public hearing in order to basically enact a special use permit or a text amendment. So the change is that there's a local government attorney ad hoc committee is working on changes to 15.2-1427 and 15.2-2204. And pull it up on my phone. So basically, right now the language says with the first notice of hearing, no more than 14 days prior to the intended passage of the ordinance. And so the proposed change would be, first of all, in Fluvanna we have a weekly newspaper where it's advertised. Goochland has the same issue. So 14 days is a tight deadline when we're not advertising the Times-Dispatch or the Daily Progress. So the proposed change is to increase the number of days for that first advertisement. And there would still have to be two advertisements once a week, but you wouldn't have that tight deadline, which hurts rural localities. So right now, I know David Bond could probably speak to it more, but when the legislation comes forward to the House and to the Senate, we just ask that you support the changes because Planning Commission, let's see, in December, we don't have 9 public hearings, and which for a rural Planning Commission, that's a lot. And we have... at our last meeting, we also deferred a solar application where there are a few hours on, and that'll be heard in January now. So basically, even though it's only required for one public hearing, we're having to have two. And if it's, you know, deferred again, then basically you'd have to have a public hearing all over again. I know it's also affected localities where they've had, like, data center public hearings, and they've had, I think it was King George County, their planning commission had to, they deferred it, and they had to have it all over again. I think their meeting went, like, 5-6 hours. So we just ask that you support it in the House and Senate when it gets there. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
And again, going back to unintended consequences of legislation, you have to do new public hearings. There's new advertisements that have to go out, and there's money associated with that. So
it's impacting the budget of advertising budget because the applicant's cost when they apply for that text amendment or special use permit was for one, you know, two advertisements for one public hearing. Now we're having to double that up when the matter's deferred. So, appreciate it.
I could just add, this was part of a much larger piece of legislation last year that was actually a lot of good work put into it by the local government groups as well as the Press Association Coalition for Open Government, looking at ways that, you know, both sides, I guess, could agree to, you know, streamline and make the process for advertising a lot of different notices more efficient. This is just one of them, I think, that, you know, once you got through this big bill, you know, folks realized that they needed to come back and address this again. Dan, I think, did this go before this working group was within the Code Commission, or did the Code Commission look at this?
I know the local government attorneys appointed an ad hoc committee to work on this, and it's Adkinson and Phil Sirico's on it, a few other members. So, but I'm not sure what delegate or senator they're working with on the amendments, because I know some of the bond notice language they were trying to amend as well, because there's some unintended consequences. So overall, it was a good bill because it got rid of the descriptive summary, which, you know, could be tough to have a perfectly accurate descriptive summary. So that was good. So there's some good parts of the bill, but just some parts that were unintended.
I have a question on this. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to figure out if this applies to something I thought about early on in my term. I think it was Village Gardens, which was a subdivision. and it got deferred. And if I remember right, I think it got deferred. If I have any portion of this wrong, the general theme is there was a deferral, and the developer, I think, had to make a change in their entrance to the subdivision, or they were, that was their choice to try to better the deal. So when they came back in front, there was not another public hearing. And citizens said to me, wait a minute, how come if the contractor gets to come back and remake their case, how come the citizens can't? And at the time, our attorney said, well, there's already been a public hearing on this item. But the very fact that they left and came back, they made a material change in their proposal. So if they, there's been a material change, then the proposal itself has changed. So the public has not already commented on the what is has been put in front of the Planning Commission. Is that good?
So it depends. If it was a rezoning and there's changes to the proffers, then you would have another public hearing. If it was an ordinance and it was more restrictive, like a text amendment, and you there's more restrictive changes, then you would have to have another public hearing. So without knowing the facts of the case, I don't know whether it was a rezoning or I could talk to Douglas about that to get more background on that case.
But that doesn't, I guess I'm just using that as an example. Does that kind of speak to potentially what we're talking about here?
Well, no, basically this, the language that we're trying to, the LGA is trying to change, it just says 14 days before the intended adoption. So basically before that, you would only have one public hearing. Now, if you defer it, your intended adoption's a new date wherever you defer the public hearing, you know, the application to. So, but you still have the state law and case law that requires if you amend the proffers, you have to have another public hearing. If you have a more restrictive amendment to the text, then you have to have another public hearing. So it doesn't change that.
All right, anything else on this topic? The next one, environment, energy, and land use, that probably be several people would like to comment on this particular issue. I think even Board of Supervisors, so some of them are going to want to chime in as well. So who wants to start?
I mean, I'll just kind of start off. You know, certainly, you know, we want to make sure that, that the localities maintain authority if there's any land use changes as it relates to any installations of solar, wind power, or anything like that. As I'm sure you know, solar is a big discussion around the Commonwealth right now, and Savannah County is certainly no different than that in that regard. So, you know, just you know, making sure that the local authority is maintained to kind of deal with any projects that come before Fluvanna County. And like I said, I know this has been a big topic on the board, and I'll have to let the board members chime in at all.
Anyone
else? I was at the VACO conference, and Eric and I attended the same session where there was a discussion by the county supervisor from Loudoun County and Dominion Energy. The county supervisor, I'm sorry, I don't remember his name.
Supervisor Ashburn, or Turner from, from Loudoun.
He literally said, we almost need a war council to address energy demands that are being put forth right now. And, you know, Dominion gave examples of how they're trying to expand their system to meet the demands that are being put upon them. Primarily, talking about data centers and how that expanded, how that's coming out into this area, and how much energy they're required to bring to the table. And then, of course, when you look at their ability to put in new power plants and the timing of the amount of effort that it takes to do that is substantial. So they're really clamoring for energy from any source that they can get it, which is why you're kind of seeing this expansion from, you know, what was traditionally kind of passive solar gains being happening, you know, slowly to now a real huge push for it, which is why it's impacting localities like Savannah. But it doesn't solve the energy demands that Dominion needs to bring to the table. And one example that was given was just the advent of AI itself will probably lead to a fivefold increase of energy demands for data centers. which was pretty substantial. Another example that was given was, while it's great that we're promoting electric vehicles, that the electric vehicle demand on the household is an increasing demand that they need. It's great. And when I say demand, of course, I mean all electric providers. So it's this balance between, what is needed for someone that might argue new economy, new energy, against what is needed by companies like Dominion, against what is needed by what localities can give to that energy demand. So I just mentioned that, I'm not really saying anything else, but if you didn't attend that session, it was very powerful.
I'm trying so hard not to go crazy. So we have legislated ourselves into an unsustainable paradigm, and I have actually made money doing solar energy development, so I think I can safely claim to not be anti-renewable energy. But tying Virginia vehicle standards to California is like stupid times 10. It is. So I'm going to go on a little rant here. There are two gas-powered power plants within 15-mile straight line of where we sit. One's probably about 4 miles straight line distance, maybe five. Those two power plants generate about 200 megawatts of electricity, plus or minus, and they generate it 24/7, 365. If you wanted to get 200 megawatts from solar at this latitude, you would be able to get it when the sun was shining, which would be about 280 days a year here, and it would take, anybody want to guess how many acres it would take to get 200 megawatts?
Is it probably like 2,000?
How about 12,000?
12,000, okay.
Now, you want to guess the combined inside the fence footprint of the two gas power plants that generate 200 megawatts inside the fence. Not the infrastructure, inside the fence, the parking lots and everything.
30 acres.
Yeah, 70. Right? And so I am absolutely pro renewable energy. It makes a whole lot more sense in the Iraqi desert where I'm trying to do it right now than it makes in Fluvanna. And you're talking about 12,000 acres. The data centers, our energy sucks. I've been around not long enough to have been here in 2010, but long enough to have been here when Virginia was a net exporter of electricity. I believe we're the third largest importer amongst the 50 states now. And that is driven primarily by data centers, which started out in Loudoun County, but are now everywhere and coming, right? So I don't know how to address it. I would love to power down the decision-making authority to all the localities as it relates to that, but the state edicts have created a paradigm where if we're going to meet the goals that have been imposed upon us by previous legislatures, we almost can't. The state almost has to force it down rural localities' throats. And it ticks me off because if you live in Arlington or Alexandria or Fairfax, then solar sounds great. But if you live in Fluvanna and you realize that to get the power generation that we get from two gas power plants on 70 acres, you need 12,000 acres, it hits a little bit harder. So I don't know the answers, but if we power it down, then you guys will turn off the valve, which I think is A-OK. And then the state will then be forced to try to figure out how to meet the demands that are incurred by virtue of the policies, that we implemented, right? For things, because if you got to plug your car in and you live in a rural area, you're going to have to plug it in a little bit longer, a little bit more frequently. So I don't know the answers, but I do know the problem. And we created it. So how we get out of it, I think one step is to power down these land use decisions to localities, because you will turn off the valve. But my fear is that then the state comes in wearing their jackboots and forces localities to do things they don't want to do. So, but if you think about that, 12,000 acres versus 7, the same amount of electricity.
There was a parallel meeting previous to that, which was about environmental challenges and growth as well, too. And we had a farmer there speaking, and the solar came up during that meeting, and a farmer there speaking about the challenges of that he took to build his farm, which is about 900 acres. We had a young man there who was talking about wanting to build his own farm as well too, and the challenges of trying to get to the point where he could do that successfully and viably. And a good comment was made there, basically say, this is a totally comprehensive challenge across the board, from agricultural to the demands of new energy, to the demands of how we work and how we do two things today, you know, computing basically. And then, you know, by the same token, we had a farmer who was from the Suffolk area or you know, lowlands area down there, was talking about how, you know, he had to destroy his watermelon field because of salination of the water. So, you know, just all of these challenges that it's easy to say, gosh, this doesn't work today, but, you know, we're increasingly seeing more and more challenges coming from climate change that are going to impact the entire state, the entire East Coast, everywhere that we are. And so that's why I think that supervisor was correct in saying that there's almost a need for a war council to put the best minds and ideas together in terms of how do we solve these challenges. Because they're not easy, they're not easy.
If I may weigh in also, I think this is the third of the greatest threats, biggest issues that our country is facing. And the fact that we are allowing, as a people, our government to tell us what kind of a car we can drive, whether or not or how we can heat our homes, what kind of appliances we can have, how we can live, under what I would submit, not just be bold, it is a hoax. This is a hoax that man can measurably impact the climate. And we get told, oh, you're a climate denier. This is settled science. Not true. This is the same settled science rationale that was the COVID science, too. That only one narrative, only one viewpoint, this was settled, you only could treat it this way. And the government suppressed information, suppressed viewpoint, did not allow science to be challenged. This war on affordable, reliable energy, this suicide pact that we as a country, and as a led by the UN and the WHO, it's fossil fuels, the truth is, have brought more prosperity and industry around the globe than anything else to third world countries. This is crushing third world countries, poor countries. We're trying to force them off of reliable, affordable energy, fossil fuels. More people die from cold than from heat across the planet. We are the largest clean energy producer in the world. We're much better than the Middle Eastern countries or Russia or China or whomever. And the fact that we would willfully, purposely get off of reliable, affordable energy and subsidize with our tax dollars unaffordable, unreliable energy that will never be the solution, never. 4% of the world's energy comes from renewables. 4%. Wind and solar. Burning wood is more still than the 4% comes from renewables. That's the truth of it. And this push, and I fear the country, we are the proverbial frog in the boiling water pot that will realize too late what we have done. The estimate is that to reach the Paris Climate Accord goal, the energy restriction of fossil fuel production and usage, you would have to take what we did during the 3 months worth part of the shutdown during the COVID pandemic and do that for 10 years, spend $100 trillion. I mean, when we shut down the country and the economy and industry for 3 months, do that for 10 years, spend $100 trillion, that's $150,000 per citizen, and then we might lower the Earth's temperature by some half degree over a 50-year period. Electric vehicles cost $70,000 average. I'm going to bet most people, I've never spent more than $30,000 on a vehicle. Never bought a new vehicle cost them. That's with government subsidies. Almost everyone who owns an electric vehicle are elite, wealthy people who is their second or third vehicle because you can't own it as your own vehicle. It's impractical as a sole vehicle, certainly not unless you commute around a little city there. It's not sustainable. It's not practical. It's not, the automobile companies are losing money on every electric vehicle they put out, and the people don't want it. When I travel to Fifth District, and I'll be in a group setting, I'll say, how many of you own an electric vehicle? It's zero or one. Now, I don't have Northern Virginia, and it's probably a little different in the bluest part of my district, not far from here in Charlottesville. But it's unbelievable what we're doing here. And to tie, as Tom said, we tie our energy policy at the state level to California. Let's tie our crime policy sheriff to Chicago, I guess. It's unbelievable what we're doing here. And I fear the country and the Commonwealth are not suffering enough from the harm from these policies because of what happened, you know, 3 weeks ago here. But this issue, and it ought to be local control, local authority, as this says. It ought not to be from the state. Gosh, it shouldn't be from the federal level. But this is purposeful, and this is intentional. It's unbelievable. The president has said he's looking at every issue through a climate lens, every issue. Even our military is being forced onto electric vehicles. Even our military. Think about the insanity about that. In the theater of war, Tom's a veteran, Chris is a veteran, we probably got some other veterans in here. Think about that. That we would allow the climate impact, supposedly the alleged climate impact, to determine military policy, military readiness, military lethality, military. So, and I'm on Tom Sage won't be on the rant. I guess I'm on a worse rant. But this issue is literally going to destroy the country, and it's for no reason. When I was a county supervisor in Campbell, I voted for and supported. Solar farms in Campbell County. We were one of the first counties we didn't do it. My thought was, because I'm an all the above guy, I don't think we're going to use our tax dollars and subsidize an unaffordable, unreliable energy and pick winners and losers and punish and prohibit through permitting, through exploration, through drilling, reliable, affordable energy. But so because of that, again, I'm for renewable energy, not against it. But, and letting property owners do what they want to do, but as it has exploded and I've seen the impact on my district, I wish we'd been much more discriminating and much more scrutinizing, because what we did do was we had the buffer zones and we had the vegetation barriers and we had the distance from the highway and the sound and the bonding for the company so that you could make sure we got stuck with trying to clean it up after. But as I've seen it take over some of my counties, I wish we'd been even more discriminating and more restrictive than we've been. I don't know exactly what Flavanna has been on that, but this is a critical issue, and the fact that we have forced ourselves off of energy independence now, reliable on dirty energy producers to ship the oil to us, ocean liners across the ocean that don't produce it as clean, that's the biggest polluters there is. Europe is 20 years ahead of us on everything when it comes to progressiveness. They're trying to get back to fossil fuels now because they're freezing over there and they know it doesn't work. We're sadly gonna learn that lesson ourselves, the painful part way, I think. But anything you can do to push, and it's important for people to know about it. I encourage you to do your research and do your homework on this because it's not the settled times that they would have us believe. And you almost, I feel like I'm about the only congressman who says what I just said because everybody's afraid to say it. Everybody's afraid to say it because of the criticism you get when you say it.
Okay, Jim.
Ms. Brooke, I'm going to add one point.
Yes,
because
please.
I had no always said it as a commissioner. And Dr. Garrett has nailed it down with the gas-fired plants. One of the points that he made, I'm sure he knows, because he's much more knowledgeable than I, those gas-fired plants only use about 35,000 gallons of water a year, a day, which is less than the average golf course uses to water there. Because I remember we'd have had two of them in Flavanna if 2007 hadn't been such a negative turn in their economy. The second was on the book, Tom. They backed away because the economy tanked. And there are a couple of concerns. So again, one of those, the water usage is just minuscule compared to what most, you know, power plants are. So, and the other thing that kicks this concern for me, if we try to stay in front of the state statute language for solar, but man, it changes from session to session aggressively. And I know, we all know why, the energy lobby is monstrous, but you know, we're not getting, the counties aren't going to get wealthy on solar farms, I'll just tell you that. And the biggest concern I have is when you look at the ones that are on the books and proposing for Flavanna, it's all a subsidiary of Dominion. They're not Dominion that's got their reputation and their finances online, the subsidiaries. They're 30 and 40 year leases, and those 30 and 40 year leases, of course, have bonding, like Congressman Good said, to, you know, complete their, you know, reconstitution if they take them down. But if those LLCs that are set up, I won't call them shells, but they're individual, you know, companies that are put together on behalf of Dominion, when they fold, I don't know, 30, you know, those leases are 30 to 40 years. Panels right now, roughly 4x8, maybe 4x7. Well, how big were our cell phones 25 years ago? You know, those solar panels will probably be the size of our cell phones in 15 years, generate more power instead of 7 acres to give you a megawatt. And now it's down to 5.5 because they got them where they track the sun. But the technology improved so aggressively. I really, really, truly worry. As a guy that's got to assess those fields, well, they're tax exempt for the most part. You know, we're not making any dollars off of them, just the land sitting under those panels. I worry about who has to reconstitute those fields and put them back into the natural environment they were before the leases were put in place. I believe that's going to end up falling on local government at some point. And for that reason alone, I hope we are judicious in what we approve as we move through that, the at least our piece of that solar decision making.
Yeah, thank you, ma'am. We probably could spend more time here, but we do have a time limit. And we have our safety that we need to. Yeah, I circled that our club rate increase. I circled that too. I'm sure that's what you want to bring up. Go ahead.
Why don't we do the public safety? Because I would like Mr. Garrett to be here for that as well too. So.
I'll talk really quick about public safety. Just a couple things, you know, having first responders. Is a challenge in the Commonwealth right now. So again, you know, we just ask that additional resources are allocated to assist localities with, you know, first responders, recruitment, retention, training, and support. Fluvanna County just this summer put in place its first paid EMS providers in the county. And so that's been a big, big undertaking. But, you know, certainly too, you know, in the future, there's going to be that fire component of it too. And so we just ask that, you know, as you're looking at the budget, you know, just making sure that there's resources to assist localities to help with first responders. And then just the last thing, one bill that's coming forward that kind of went through VACO. So looking for changes to the Line of Duty Act that would allow trained private law enforcement agencies, there's 8 of them in the Commonwealth right now, allowing them to have the same benefits that sheriff's office deputies have if they're killed in the line of duty. This kind of stemmed from up at Wintergreen in Nelson County. They had an officer that was killed in the line of duty. And, you know, and so Fluvanna County, they also have a private police force with Lake Monticello. So we would just ask that anything that comes forward, again, we've looked at it. There's no fiscal impact to the localities. It's just allowing these private private police enforcement agencies the same benefits that a sheriff's office would if that officer is killed in the line of duty. So those are the only two for public safety. And like I said, happy to answer any questions on any of those.
Well, I'm going to speak mostly about Commonwealth attorneys, and we have a little thing on earlier about comp board positions, and I'm going to talk about. We just finished, as the Virginia Association of Commonwealth Attorneys, a comprehensive time study, which is the first one that's ever been done. The General Assembly paid for it because we've been banging on them for money for so long. And we had 96%, I think, of the prosecutor, over 1,000 prosecutors in the state, wrote down time for everything they did for about 5 months. And the numbers came back, which we thought it would, showing how many different things our assistants and we electeds do that aren't really part of the compensation. Right now, we're mandated to do felonies, and we may do class 1 and 2 misdemeanors as far as prosecution goes. So I'm just asking that when those numbers come to you, and please reach out to me or Colin Stolle, anybody else at the Commonwealth Attorneys Compensation Committee, we really think it's important. And it's a great step, because I think the General Assembly is starting to see that there is a difference between what prosecutors do, even assistant Commonwealth attorneys, and public defenders. When we're always kind of put on this panel, well, they're making this much, they should make this much. And I'm not putting down what public defenders do. I wouldn't do it. But when you look at what we do as far as the mandates on prosecutors, the ethical considerations of prosecutors, the different things we have to take into consideration, we're not just handed a stack of files and walk into court and do a bunch of bond hearings and go back. And I'm not trying to downplay, because public defenders do a lot to keep the system fair. But they don't do what prosecutors do. And we're trying to break away from that kind of being coupled to them, to those offices, as far as the compensation goes. So if we can take a look at those numbers when they come to you, we've gotten a lot of assistance from the General Assembly in the last few years as far as some basic raises and things for assistance, because we're having trouble with retention of prosecutors and hiring of prosecutors. Even big offices are not getting applications when they have openings. Part of that's money, a lot of it is money, but part of it is, of course, the general turn away from law enforcement and prosecution in society, which is, you know, we're trying to work on that misperception as well. But anyway, for the delegate in the Senator's office, we'll be up there this session with those numbers, and I'm happy to explain them to you. But it is very important that we kind of put something behind the money that you spent for that study, to take that seriously and apply it as best you can. Thank you.
So, sure. You're wasting your breath, because I'm already there. How many prosecutors work in your office?
I've got just me and one assistant.
Right. Okay. So I remember working General District Court dockets where I counted that it was me against 23 or, you know, 15 or 30. Yeah. And the reason that the prosecutor is able to keep up with that load is because the sheriff's offices tend to give us good cases. You know, 99.78% of the time you're not arresting innocent people. But it's overwhelming, and Cumberland County has one. You have one plus one. I mean, it's insane. So yeah, I'm already there. I'm gonna hit closing and shut up. So foster care, raising the age from 14 to 16 to allow them to opt out, essentially, got it. And Secretary of Rural Virginia got it. Unfunded mandates, always, right? And you guys are well represented, by the way, by David in Richmond. Deferred public hearings and fixing the rule of unintended consequences so that you don't have to do public hearings about public hearings. I got it. Line of Duty Act changes, I'm all for it. I think it was Wintergreen, and I think Bridgewater had one too.
Bridgewater
said it, yeah. So it happens, right? And but my ask is this. There's one of me, and we will probably have ballpark 3,000 bills this session. And I think I'm good at this. I think I'm going to be better at it now that I'm sober for 2,005 days. Praise God. Give credit where it's due. But if you guys can delegate somebody to take my cell number and say there's a bill coming up today, to track the General Assembly session, pick the 20 bills that matter to you and say there's a bill coming up today and this is how we want you to vote on it. I promise you I will not always do what you want. I guarantee it. But I will never do what you want if I don't know what you want. Right, so that would be so greatly appreciated, whether it's the county administrator or a member of the board. Whatever you do, don't let Mel do it. I'm kidding. I'm so used to having colonels tell me what to do. But that would be awesome, because we will have 100 votes in a day, and it's like being a prosecutor general as a court docket, you know? I'm doing it on the fly. I'm going to miss some. So if you guys can just text and say, here are the 10 bills that are up this week that we give a darn about, and this is what we hope you'll do. I guarantee you I'll be with you more often than I would if you didn't do that.
So I got one thing to add to that, Delegate Garrett, is under 9.1101, which delegates the authority to law enforcement for their job. Like with the Lake Police being a private police department, it does not specifically in that say private police department. So where they have four people over there working at the lake and they do a great job, we're having to pick up the all the arrests and everything that's going on for the lack of that clear understanding, and they just left them off. They added S cops, they added everybody else, but they did not add private police departments.
Can you text me something like that?
I'll say,
where I'm literally going to Richmond after this to start refiling calls.
Absolutely. And Eric Dahl addressed the biggest issues. Nobody is 100% staffed. And the competition for those that want to work nights, weekends, and holidays is dwindling. I think we've had a total of 3 applications in a couple of months, but it's industry wide. And then you get into the, for some of the people that are burned out after a period of time, they're going to the other jobs like ABC, alcoholic beverage here in Virginia. You can walk in their door at $71,000 certified, and you can walk in Fluvanna for 51. So, there's a big discrepancy there, and they're taking those seasoned officers from agencies for those jobs. Our state police in Virginia is down probably close to 300.
We had an African-American sheriff, and you guys did too, in Sheriff Washington, and we couldn't keep an African-American deputy because Henrico and Fairfax would come snatch him. And when you want a community police, when you want to get out in the areas and let young people see people that look like them and maybe share some of their life experiences, it's real hard when you can't keep them on staff. The only number that blows people's minds more than how few prosecutors work in Fluvanna is how many patrol deputies are on the road at any given time?
We flex them during the times that we need them. In the mornings, you might only have 2, but then in the heart of the day, when you really are busy, you have 5 if we're lucky.
So you're averaging probably 3.5 deputies.
We have 7 in the courts, which are mandated. I wish I had 7 on the road.
It's insane.
We were fortunate to get grants and stuff. We have 5 SROs for our schools, and that's wonderful. But the meat of law enforcement is answering the calls for service for the public. And over a period of time, you can add, pay for, the hours you work, shift differentials and stuff like that. But the competition in and around the communities around us, every time our board has been so generous giving money, but every time they give us some, everybody else gets money. And where we were down here and we move up a notch or two, then we're back down a notch or two, So it's turned into a competition. So to speak, and again, a great example of that is City of Charlottesville. It's probably been down more officers than anyone with all the problems that they've had. But the new chief there, Mike, is an awesome guy. He has taken and just produced the most diverse group of police officers in that community, and he did it because he had the finances. They offer $20,000 sign-on bonuses. But they attracted the type of people that you need. And in our minority community, that is our biggest competition, to get people to come out and apply even, but to get them to want to come to work. And you need that. You have to reflect your community in your agency. And you have to have, women, and you have to have minorities. You have to have all those things to be able to do your job like you should. And it's getting harder and harder. And as you get into that part of it, it's a whole new variable. The other is there are police departments and sheriffs around the country right now that can't get vehicles. Still catching up from COVID. My vehicle was finally, after 2 years, I get my crash avoidance system put in because they finally caught up to where they can add that to the vehicle. But there are no police cars. They're not building those cars because they're making more money off of the commercial side. I mean, the private side. I'll give you one quick example, and I'll stop. With the F-150 Pursuit truck went up $50,000 in 2 years. So every vehicle we have that we were lucky, we were very fortunate, the board gave us some added things, and we were able to pick up vehicles. Everybody else said, where did you get those vehicles? How'd you get those vehicles? And we were very fortunate. And that's with the new strike and everything that's just hopefully been resolved. I don't see it getting any better. And it's not just with the vehicles, it's with everything that goes into vehicles. Since COVID, it has gone up exponentially. The tasers are an example. They've gone up probably 200% in that time period. And it's a valuable tool that they have a monopoly on, and they're able to dictate to you what you will spend on that. But anything you can do to help reduce the costs of some of the things that we have to have to do our job safely, and to incentivize young people to get involved in law enforcement would be well appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you.
I would just like to say mainly two things, but very quickly. One is a ceiling bill that I would love to spend more time discussing with you. Basically, in 2021, the General Assembly put in place a bill that started out with just sealing marijuana convictions after a certain period of time, that then expanded to a number of convictions. And sealing's different than expungement. So sealing puts all of a lot of the work on my office, and they did not have proper financial numbers as to how much this will fiscally impact the Commonwealth, as well as specifically my office. But it takes, they did a study in Virginia Beach, just, and it doesn't matter what county it was done in, because they just did studies on one specific cases. And one case, it took 4 to 6 hours to seal, because what they did was they used district court and the programs that they can use. Well, district court are not courts of record, which means they can push a button and seal their records. Our office is, we're public records. We have public records. So we have to go through not only our computer systems, but our books, and everywhere. We have to go to the Library of Virginia through microfilm. We have to, I mean, all of these places, all of our backup copies, and all of these, because of disaster recovery, we have to go through all of that now for one case. And so every case takes 4 to 6 hours to seal, at least. And we're not talking, I mean, we're talking about a number of cases. And I can't just, if let's say I needed, I can't just hire somebody to do that job. I have to take one of my experienced individuals to be able to do that, because they're the only ones that would know where to look for those cases. So it's going to have a huge impact on local, on the localities, because we're going to be having to come and ask for more people. This, it didn't, doesn't come into effect until July 1st, 2025. They gave 4 years in order for us to try to come up with how to fund it, well, the state, how to fund it, and how we're going to do it. But if we don't start paying attention to it and getting it either repealed, which I think probably won't happen, but at least changed, it has no start date either. I mean, so it means that I have to go back to 1777, when our county, and I have to remove all charges relating to certain types of charges from our books from 1777 forward. It's a nearly impossible task. So I just, that's the one thing that I would love to mention. Two is the Commonwealth mentioned, you know, a study that they had done. I would like to have, we've been pushing for years to have a similar study done in the clerk's office, because the workload studies that have been done for the clerk's offices were done 30 years ago. And haven't been done since. And so the workload that is being placed on, you know, certain items, I mean, that workload has changed, not to mention duties that have been added to the clerk's office. We're now the stopping point for making sure that the sheriff's offices do their fingerprintings and all of that. We have to take up and make sure that all of the fingerprints have been done on all charges. So, I mean, duties have been added to our office, and it's not being taken into consideration. So.
Ms. Booker, I'll just say it too, that every constitutional officer works with the comp board, and it's terribly underfunded. I want to thank the Board of Supervisors in Fluvanna and many other localities that, thank God, you know, plus up the comp board funding. In fact, if they're passed it, comp board is just a small part of most of the budgets that we require to run our office. We work on study across the board for every constitutional office. They're lousy. They don't. If we had to live with what the comp board pays, reimburses Fluvanna or pick any other county, we would just simply be unable to run the offices. So thank the board for tremendously increasing that from salaries to actual operating funds. I wanted to thank Delegate Garrett and his company of delegates and senators for career development. That's an opportunity that every constitutional officer has for our staffs. We take advantage of it, and y'all are by and large just about funded at 100%, and please continue that. It gives us the opportunity to have better staff, better educated staff, more well-rounded. And last, I want to thank Congressman Good's office. One of the things that we talked about public safety, but they were kind enough to pick a bill up and carry it, I think, nationally that that would give us some relief here in Fluvanna and every other county in the country on public safety vehicles emission standards. We're getting killed in there with their fire vehicles, in particular larger vehicles. The public emission standards really add to the cost and inhibit your operational capability, because it's really embarrassing when you got a fire call or a rescue squad call and you get up there and the first thing you do when you crank the vehicle is got to wait 15 minutes for the emissions equipment to get to reset itself and burn through. The military, correct me if I'm wrong, but I know Congressman Good can speak to it. Like, the military has got an exemption from that because of the necessity of
for
the
now.
For now. And I don't want to begin to talk about electric vehicles and what that would be on us nationally. But thank you for picking that bill up. He looked at, picked that up, that would exempt public safety vehicles. And you know, that sounds lofty when we say nationally, but you guys buy new fire trucks and rescue units every year. And God, it's frustrating when you go up and crank the vehicle to run a call and it's got to sit there for over 10 minutes and reset itself before you can leave the station.
Okay,
he was kind enough to pick that up for us.
Thank you. Last week we had Supervisor O'Brien would like to speak about Aqua rate increase and anything else any supervisor speak.
So I represent the lake, so all of my constituents are under Aqua. Aqua Virginia is requesting a 33.8% rate increase. That rate increase is 10 times the state average for public utilities in terms of delivering water. The average for the rate raising report in 2022 was 3.8%. So 33.8. This is supposedly a private company, which is more efficient than government, but yet they are already charging lake residents almost triple, 2.5 times the average rate that ratepayers pay throughout the rest of the county. And they are asking for that 33.8% increase, which would bring the average water bill for a lake resident to about $190 a month. This is just profiteering. And they haven't even been very good with the service that they're delivering. It is unconscionable, in my opinion. Now, they will tell you that they have to make these improvements, they need to make changes and so on. But, you know, they've been operating the system for almost 15 years now, and they've asked for those rate increases in the past to do the same thing. It's not that difficult to assume what your maintenance costs are on a regular basis. I would ask that you speak to your colleagues at the SEC, tell them this is an unfair rate increase, tell them this is not conscionable in any way, shape, or form.
Does Aqua run the water for anybody other than Lakewood?
They do run water, so just to put it in perspective, Aqua Virginia serves 8,000 residents for water and sewer, 5,000 of them here at the lake, 3,000 are in other areas. Another perspective is they-
What other areas?
Caroline County.
Are they
and are they getting smoked like you guys are?
We are, everybody's getting in. So Caroline County's getting in?
I think Nelson County,
Stony Creek is under them, and they're getting in. To put it in perspective, Stony Creek residents pay basically what we pay here. To deliver services at the bottom of the valley there. To the road, yeah, Nelson County is able to deliver services at the top of the valley, far more effective county, at a reasonable rate, right? So this is not about
us being giving water water away to people at the bottom of the valley 2,000 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is a real problem for, half of the population of Trevada County, and I need your support. So I'm just putting that out there to say, talk to your representatives, if you're going to hear from people, your constituents here, and say this is not right. This is wrong.
Thank you. Anything else? Would one of you want to leave and make a comment?
You asked about other people. The representative, Supervisor Black, represents the area in Caroline that is under Aqua's services, and he has approached us multiple times about trying to come back to go after them.
Legally.
Legally.
Yeah, legally. And privatization of water is about 10% of the water systems out there. In almost all cases, it's double the cost. It's just an example of, you know, how privatization is an oil as a possible solution for your residents. And this has a large impact on our community, because if you think about it, at the lake, if you've got a $200 a month water bill, what does that do to your home values? I mean, it has an impact, period. If I can live outside the lake and not inside the lake and pay a much lesser cost, that's an impact that people are gonna make when they're buying homes. Takes away from their pocketbooks. We've been talking about that. You know, this is just an example of a company taking away from our pocketbooks to give to shareholders.
One of the key elements of benefit privatization is competition. You have a competition.
There is no competition. Exactly. And you can't compete. The only thing you can do is everyone else.
Okay, so anything else?
I would just like to, yeah. I know I'm preaching to the choir, but I'll say a quick one, but back to the solar piece and us keeping control of that locally. Last year, a group of us went and met with a group out of Appomattox, and it just made it to where there would be no solar in A1. It can only be in industrial. And really what that was a move to slow things down and say, we're not going to lose by not having this yet locally, but we could lose by having it, too much of it and not understanding it. And what I've learned is that there's this big buildup to the solar movement, tons of money, tons of organizational preparation, but the reaction to it, now that it's rolling out, has not had that gear up, that ramp up. And so certainly it should stay at our level to be able to make our decisions over what happens on our properties.
Okay, thank you. Anything else? If not, we would like to thank our legislators and the representatives for being here. And I can pretty much say that we have had a good conversation. A great deal, and we have put a lot of issues on you to attend to or at least help us with, and we hope that you will be able to do that and that we can continue to communicate with you and you can communicate with us. We do this once a year. When you get busy, you just don't have time. But it'd be nice sometimes to sit down later on just to see what have we really accomplished, because we do it and we need to, and we want to know that what we're doing is heard and that and we can get some results from when we pass this over to you. So we thank you. We thank all the staff and everyone's here today. You were so well prepared and you spoke with so much knowledge about what's going on in this county, and really it's an opportunity for us to see what a great county we have and what great people that we have that's serving the citizens of this county. So I hope for all of you a nice Thanksgiving and Christmas and any other big holiday. And I know we'll see Dave will be back to see us, but we want you to come back and visit with us. And I'd like to thank the supervisors for being here and being engaged. And of course, I can't leave out my little lady here, Caitlin, that's working away at the computer, and Kelly, and the attorney, and Eric for everything that they do. Did I miss somebody?
The Constitution.
Constitution and the school board, yes.
And the superintendent.
Yes.
Yeah, I thank staff, too, for putting this together. Yes. They did all the work on this, right. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. And you'll have a great day.
Motion to adjourn.
All right. Anybody? I'm not going to ask anybody.
Happy birthday.